My name is Michael O'Toole. I'm 60 years old. Today is October 21st, 2017, and we're in downtown Chicago, Chicago, Illinois, and I'm here with my buddy and colleague from the Old Town School of Folk Music, Mike Blackburn.
My name is Mike Blackburn. I am 64 years old. Today is the 21st of October, 2017. We're at the Chicago Cultural Center in downtown Chicago, Illinois. And I am here with my longtime pal and colleague from the Old Town School of Folk Music.
So we were talking earlier today about how we got into playing music when we were kids. So why don't you tell me about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. How I got interested in playing music was when I was a young boy. Probably my mother was a piano player and my father was a trumpet player. So I always used to sit around, playing with my toys as a child, listening to my parents play the piano. My mother and my father would play the trumpet. I wasn't really into it at the time, especially my father's trumpet playing. Although he was very good, I didn't appreciate it at the time. My mother was a very good piano player, very entertaining. She sang. Oh, she was so good. And she always had that stage presence with us, and she would look at us when she sang, you know, which I always used to, and she'd say, and she'd sing something funny, and she'd look at you, you know, and it's engaging. I really enjoyed that. I acquired a ukulele when I was about 9 years old through a church raffle, and my mother tuned it up and taught me how to play it. And after a while, I started singing along with her some of the common standards at the time, you know, 5'2", how are you, blah, blah, blah. And eventually my grandmother won a 5-string banjo at a church raffle.
You did well with those church raffles.
Oh, that's right. She brought it home, handed it to me, here, play. Well, nobody knew what it was, and you couldn't look things up on Google at the time, and living in Chicago, we had no idea that a 5-string banjo wasn't necessarily indigenous to our northern lifestyle. Wasn't until Beverly Hillbillies came up on TV that we realized that's my banjo. My father tried to find a guy. Should I go into that story,
yeah.
Do you think? My father hired a guy. He thought he knew, could teach me how to play the banjo. And this guy shows up on a Saturday morning. I'm 10 years old. He's got a fedora on, a black raincoat, short in stature, and carrying a banjo case. He opens up the banjo, my banjo case, and he looks, he says, "Oh, I can't teach you how to play this banjo. I don't play this style." I said, my father says, "Well, where can I learn how to play this style of banjo for him?" He says, "No, I have no idea." He says, "You're going to have to move to Kentucky." So baffled, you know, there was a little bit of an exchange with this fellow and my father and about payment, and hence there we go. My father was a Chicago police officer, and he was assigned around the Old Town area at this time. We're talking 1963. And one day he's driving past a place, and he saw a bunch of people standing out in front playing banjos.
That would be the first location of the
right.
School on North
Avenue. That would have been at North and Larrabee, right. Exactly. And gets out of his car and he says, "Hey, what kind of instrument is that you're playing?" He says, "That's a 5-string banjo." He says, "Where can my son learn how to play that?" He points at the place right here, Old Town School of Folk Music at North and Larrabee it was. My dad walked in, signed me up for Saturday classes for 10 weeks. And by golly, he took me there every Saturday for 10 weeks. If it wasn't then, I got introduced to one of the most wonderful places on the planet. For me at the time, I was very starstruck with a lot of the people. The atmosphere was great. It seemed like hundreds of people were just sitting around, just finding different their own little niche, their own little corner of playing all kinds of instruments, mostly five-string banjos, believe it or not. A lot of guitar and a lot of picking that I've never really was familiar with.
Finger-picking flat, on guitar? Do you mean
finger-picking,
picking,
flat-picking, you name it, real guitar playing. I thought, oh, my goodness, not just strumming like we would learn in the neighborhood, if you will, on the guitar. Boy, these guys really knew how to play. I was enamored for 10 weeks, and there you go. I went on with my life after that.
Uh-huh.
1 year later, 1964, the Beatles came around, and everybody had to have an electric guitar. So I kind of put, you know, the folk guitar away for a while. Got into that, really learned how to play chords and some riffs, if you will. And it was a lifelong thing all the way through college and other aspects of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
I got into music kind of the same way. I liked all those cowboy TV shows, Roy Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Rogers get out and sing a song at the end, and he had a guitar, and I thought that was real cool. So my mom and dad got me a plastic ukulele with cowboys on it. I was probably about three. And there's a picture of me sitting there, and I'm holding it left-handed. I'm a lefty, natural lefty. I play right-handed now, but there's a picture of me holding it left-handed.
Oh, really?
And with a straw cowboy hat sitting in the living room. You know, I've still got that picture. And But I didn't know how to tune it. I didn't know how to play it. Nobody knew how anything to do with it. It was basically a toy. But I always wanted a guitar. And so it's 1964. It's my seventh birthday, February 9th, and the Beatles hit Ed Sullivan. And I'm thinking, this is pretty cool stuff. And I must have begged for a guitar for years after that. Well, finally, I'm about 10 years old, maybe 10 or 11, and they get me for Christmas. I see this guitar case, this box under the tree, and I'm thinking it's got to be a guitar. I've been begging for a guitar, and I open it up, and it's a plastic M&E guitar. It's got one wound string on the sixth string and five nylon strings, and it's plastic. You can't tune it. You can't do anything with this thing. And it was the first time I remembered feeling like not being taken seriously, like I'm growing up and you got me a toy guitar, you know. I was a little disappointed about that. But a few months later, so this would be 68, maybe 69 by now, a bunch of guys from St. Gertrude's grade school up in Edgewater, decided we're going to be a band. And Donnie Heffern and the Smith twins, John and Mark, and me, these guys find out that they're giving free music lessons at Margate Park down at Argyle and the lake. And they're going to give you an instrument, right? So this is the greatest deal ever, right? You just have to give them your mom's name and phone number, and they're going to send you home with an instrument. And so I'm going to be the guitar player, and one of the Smith brothers is going to be the drummer, and the other one's going to play bass, and Donnie's going to be the keyboard player. So we get on the Broadway bus, you know, and one afternoon and after school, and we go down to Argyle, and we walk past all the hillbilly bars, you know. And my mom says, now, be careful down there. There's a lot of Appalachian whites. And I didn't know what she was talking about, you know. We go down, we get to the park, and Donnie, you know, gives him his mom's name and phone number, and he wants to be the piano player, the keyboard player, and they give him an accordion. Well, he, you know, an accordion? It's 1969. Nobody.
Right.
I didn't start getting into the accordion until I was like 30, you know,
right,
or about 11 or 12.
Right.
And so he kind of drops off after a couple of lessons. And John or Mark Smith, who was going to be the drummer, didn't get a whole set of drums. He just got a little drum practice pad and two sticks. So he's a little disappointed. He's kind of disappointed about this. And they didn't even have a bass for the other brother. But they had this old guitar. They had this Kingston. And it was probably a classical guitar, but they had it strung with steel strings. And eventually it just kind of caved in on itself. But I thought, well, this is a great deal. I'll take this guitar and I'll come back for lessons. And we went and we got a case for the guitar, I think, at some music store. My dad found it downtown. So I was going back every week to Margate Park. And Mr. Mel, the park district guy who taught all the instruments, trumpet, accordion, everything. He plays a little guitar. He says, well, I'm going to teach you C, F, and G7. We're going to teach you down by the riverside. Well, if you're a beginning guitar player, C, F, and G7 are pretty hard chords to play. You know, we usually start with a lot simpler stuff. So I thought, this is too much. I'm going to be a lead guitar player. And my cousin was taking guitar lessons. So he taught me how to read music and pick out the notes of the melody on the guitar. So time goes by, the lessons that I guess I completed the first class at Margate and got through it, and now the classes are going to be at night. Well, my mom doesn't want me going down there at night. And so my dad and I go back to return the guitar. And I'm all bummed out because, you know, now I'm not going to have a guitar, and I've got to cajole my dad into getting me one somehow. So we go down there, and I'm bringing the guitar back, and Mr. Mel says, well, did you learn how to play anything? I said, well, I can play Georgie Girl. I can play the melody. Hey there, Georgie Girl, you know, on the guitar. And to this day, I can still play it as badly as I did with my thumb and no pick, out of time, you know, all the mistakes. They're ingrained. And so I play Georgie Girl. And I go to hand the guitar back, and Mr. Mel says, well, you can keep the guitar.
Oh, wow.
I thought that was great. I sang for my supper, so to speak.
You know? Oh, wow, that's great.
And so I'm about 12 and a half.
Was that the plan, you think?
The plan?
Yeah, well, you think that was a plan for him to give you the guitar?
I don't know.
Or was he just so impressed?
He was a nice guy.
He was a nice guy. That's great. See, that's what keeps you going as a musician.
Yeah, Mr. Mel.
Right.
You know, just a quick aside, years later I did a kids program at Lincoln Park Zoo, and I created this character, Professor Booney, but he was basically based on Mr. Mel.
There you go.
You know, he was a good guy. And but anyway, so I start taking guitar lessons at Andersonville Music Center in Andersonville up on Clark at Berwyn, and from a guy named Dimitri Pappas. And he's got this $1,000 Gibson jazz guitar, this thing you're afraid to even walk near it or touch it. And I went for the guitar lessons every Saturday morning for about a year, and he taught me to finger pick, taught me to play a couple little Chet Atkins things, and taught me my chords and went through the books, you know, and the Mel Bay or whatever, the Alfred book. So I learned how to read music pretty well. And but then I wanted to learn more about rock guitar, so I went up to the Guitar Emporium in Rogers Park up on Sheridan. It was in the old Granada Theater building. Mm. And there was a whole strip of hippie shops. There were head shops and record stores and the guitar store and a couple of restaurants. And starting at about 13 in 1970, I just started living up there, you know, hanging out up there all the time. And I took lessons with Justin Pomeroy, who had been in a Chicago band called The Dirty Words, D-U-R-T-Y-W-U-R-D-S. And I think they cut one single, you know, and had a little, you know, deal with that, and then they broke up. But Justin was teaching guitar there, and he taught me how to play the blues, taught me how to play electric blues. And at that time in Rogers Park, there was the this whole folk revival thing going on in Chicago, you know, with Steve Goodman, John Prine, all those guys. And I got to know guys like Marty Pfeiffer, who'd actually, our parents were friends. He babysat for me when I was a kid, and he would bring his guitar over and play. That was an influence, early influence there too. But Al Day, Mike Dougal, And little by little, started going to the No Exit Cafe, because it was an all-ages joint, and hearing people like Art Theme.
What was the place on Dearborn?
I don't know.
Do you remember the Dearborn?
No, I don't.
That was a little later. That was probably when I was starting to came back to the school. But I used to go see Marty all the time there. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, those were good. Yeah, I don't remember that place, but because I didn't get out of, I didn't go downtown too much at that in those teen years. But yeah, I started and I got all turned onto the folk music thing. You know, and I kind of gave up on the electric guitar. Kind of went in a case.
Well, you had the right, influences. I will tell you that. All
those were
guys,
good guys.
Those were guys I came into contact with much later.
Yeah, and that was all before I got to the school. But tell me how you got back.
All right,
to the school.
Well, here it goes. I went, 1963. I'm 10 years old. Went on and did my life. High school, St. Patrick High School on the northwest side of the city. Really out of the loop as far as the more artsy part of the city. Wasn't as fortunate as you might have been to be able to be on that side and be influenced. But I did have my guitar talents, if you will. The nuns found out that I could sing and play the guitar, and they made me get a part of the folk mass at the time at St. Genevieve School.
I did that, too, at St.
Gertrude's. Oh, did you? Yeah. Did you at St. Gertrude's?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it just seems, yeah, that was the thing to do. So it was, you will enjoy yourself, and you will sing these songs, and there was the Hymnal for Young Christians.
Yes.
I still have the original copy, and they threw it at me, and they said, you and so-and-so, I think his name was Frank Hurley. He was older, and we got up there. Well, that was it. I was hooked. We were the coolest thing going at the time. They packed the church for the first folk mass, and that was it. I was hooked because I could sing and because I could play a few chords and make it sound good and carry a tune properly. Oh, that was it. So that's where I took off with, I got away from the church and started doing Bob Dylan tunes.
Did you know?
Oh, my. Oh, the church wasn't happy. What are you doing? But there was one or two teachers at the school who were very much into, at that time, the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
So they got a hold of me. Said, come on over here. And so we started singing songs for the Martin Luther King movement. We Shall Overcome. I learned that one. And Kumbaya and all of that. So I was getting myself into a completely different cultural experience than my neighborhood was really used to at the time. So I turned into a cool guy for a certain aspect of people, and then I was shunned by others.
This was in high school?
This was in just the last part of grade school.
Oh, last part of grade school.
Yeah. So I graduated grade school in 1967. About then, 1966 and 1967, that whole thing changed, and it changed my whole outlook on, without even realizing it, what was going on, the injustices. I moved along, and when I went to high school, I started my own coffee shop at St. Patrick High School. Same thing, like-minded people singing Dylan songs, Joan Baez, all of it, from the 60s. Got involved with the Glee Club and the Chorus at the time, which was a little different back then because they were trying to update their reputation as a chorus and try to be more hip, if you will. And so again, everything was popular for me. I felt good. It got me through high school, and I thought, well, I really want to do this for a living if I can. This is the direction I wanted to go. Went away to college, Eastern Illinois University, and once again, right away, sought out the folk music scene, found a church over there that had, folk thing that they were trying to start, and I kind of took it over, and that became very popular on Friday nights and Saturday nights. And I started playing some of the local clubs, even though I was too young to really be in there. But they were trying to get into the folk music scene on Sundays and on off days, like on Monday nights, and got packed in. It was really great. When I finally got out of school, let me think now. When the 1975. You know what? I decided that I would want to go live down in Florida with my grandfather, who lived in Miami. I thought, oh, that'd be cool. So I did that for a while. Folk music scene wasn't very popular down there. Okay, at least not that I could find. And I said, oh, what can I do? And a friend of mine said, hey, listen, I'm going to Jamaica. You want to go? I said, well, I was just going down the street for a pack of cigarettes, but yeah, I'll go to Jamaica. So we went to Jamaica and wound up hanging around there for 3 months, digging whatever music scene we could find at the time. It turned out to be reggae music, which was very, you know, just so bizarre to me.
And that was before reggae.
And this was,
in the U.S.
In the U.S. Yeah. Wasn't very popular. I don't think anybody really knew it.
Yeah.
Well, I came back, and I came back after the 3 months, and I think Bob Marley was just starting to hit the airwaves. Jimmy Buffett just started to become very popular, and that, of course, was more my style at the time. And he was very popular, and everybody loved him, apparently, at the time. I started learning Jimmy Buffett songs. You know, I could not pick up the reggae beat. I don't think anybody can that I'm aware of. Jimmy Buffett was the guy. I followed that style. I usually played other people's tunes. I didn't write my own stuff at the time at all. And then just followed the folk rock scene, if you will. Finally, I wasn't making any money in Florida. My dad said, come back to Chicago. Try the folk scene over here. But at that time, if you remember, disco. 1976 years, 1977, 1976.
The folk scene had kind of dried up.
It dried up, you know, all the places.
Yeah.
And I was...
Can I ask you a question about the scene? I'm trying to understand it a little bit better. Like, could you talk about, like, just where this would be? Or was it a...
Sure.
Was it a culture? Was it people? Like, what made it... What made it attractive to you?
Oh, well, go ahead.
I think the folk scene, what I found attractive about it was the people, I think, mostly. I think I came to a feeling by the time I was about 15 or so that all this rock and roll business is taking itself far too seriously. And it was kind of getting into that era of glitter rock and things. And,
right.
You know, and I always had liked, you know, the looking back, the rock music that I always liked was really roots-based stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my favorite early bands was Paul Revere and the Raiders.
I
liked the Outfits, but they were kind of an R&B band, mm-hmm. you know, in a way. And and I liked a lot of the stuff that was blues-based more and,
right.
and folk-based, and I liked a lot of the electric, you know, crazy stuff. And that was the people I was around now, where I was
right.
playing in the folk group at church
right.
at St. Gertrude's in eighth grade and freshman year of high school. And I got to know, as I was saying before, I got to know people like Al Day and Marty Pfeiffer.
Great guys.
And, got to know the No Exit Cafe. And there was a big circuit of places to play in those days, most of which I was too young to get into, too. But
right.
there were... We used to gig at church coffee houses. Every mm-hmm. little church had a little coffee house, and we'd go to Palos, and we'd go Hills, and we'd go out to Park Ridge and play those places. But the big places were, well, the old Earl of Old Town was really the crown jewel of
the
scene.
It was the crown jewel, right.
There was the Quiet Night on Belmont.
Earl Pianchi.
Earl Pianchi had the Earl of Old Town right at North and Wells.
Right.
And... all the national acoustic folk acts came through there.
Steve Goodman.
There was Amazing Grace up in Evanston. That was a great place. It was on Northwestern's campus.
Right.
And again, a lot of the national folk acts came through there. And that was a coffee house, so we could go as teenagers,
right,
and hang out there.
Yeah, you mentioned you talk about the culture of the whole thing. You know, there were two camps happening there. You had the rock and roll camps,
mm-hmm,
and then the folk camps. You know, and both were very popular, but very rarely did they intertwine. We're talking about times like Woodstock. What year was that? 1969, right?
Yeah.
Was that considered the summer of love, or was that 1967? What is that? So that whole culture was starting to split up a lot of the 50s beatnik people who were just a tad bit older than a lot of people, and then at the same time a big influence.
Yeah.
So you either went folk or you went hardcore.
You kind of did one or the other, but
yeah,
not both. Yeah. But that's how I got over to the school eventually when I was a teen. Was,
right,
I'd been hanging around the folk scene, and I played guitar, and I found a mandolin for $40 at the Guitar Emporium. It was, mm-hmm, one of those old Italian round-back mandolins that were just falling apart, impossible to play. Action, you know, strings felt like a cab ride from the strings to the frets, you know. Big,
it looked like a big
play.
Construction boot.
Yeah, big construction boot. And I got this thing, and then somebody told me that the fiddle, the violin, had the same tuning as the mandolin.
Huh.
I said, oh, okay, well, I want to learn a little bit about the fiddle.
I didn't learn that till I was 50.
See? Stick with me. I'll tell you some stuff. And so this guy at Gordon Tech, I went to Gordon Tech High School, and I was maybe a freshman or maybe a sophomore, and this guy, Jerry Sasso, who played the drums in the jazz band, says, well, you know, my grandpa's got this violin. He never plays. I'll lend it to you.
Wow.
Great. So he brings me this violin, and I have to get some strings put on it and this and that. And there was Fritz Reuter was a violin maker up on Howard Street right by the train. And I took it up there, and he, you know, for a couple of bucks, he put some strings on it and spiffed it up a bit. And I go, well, I don't know how to, I'm trying to scratch on it. I sound terrible on this thing. You know, what do I do? And I find out that John Prine, his brother, Dave, is teaching fiddle at the Old Town School of Folk Music. And I am this big John Prine fan. His first album had just come out in 72. And Dave played on one cut. He played on Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the album was all Nashville people.
Right.
And I just thought, this is great. I'm gonna go meet John Prine's brother, and I'm gonna go down to this Old Town School of Folk Music. And I knew about the school, but I'm one of those guys, I can't go anywhere I haven't been. I was always, oh, they won't like me. I'm 15 years old. I was intimidated.
It's intimidating.
Yeah. But I knew some people that were, you know, teaching and doing lessons there, and so I went down and signed up. It was the first class. It was the 8th of January, 1973, and that's a fiddle tune, the 8th of January.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll always remember that date. And we went to the class, and we went upstairs, what's now Room 6. It used to be called Seeger East and Seeger West,
mm-hmm,
these two rooms that would connect. They were
right,
all named after folk singers,
right,
back then. There was Josh White and Guthrie Hall and all this stuff. And the building on Armitage was in disrepair already at that point.
Horrible.
It was kind of
crumbling
down. But Dave taught the class, and it was all by ear. Everybody would bring a cassette recorder, you know, this monster, like you say, like the construction boot cassette player.
Right.
We'd plug them all into wherever we could find an outlet, or they ran on batteries, and
right,
we'd record the classes,
right,
and learn the tunes. Well, I knew how to read music, so I'd go home, and I'd write out. Once I learned the tune, I'd write the notes
down for myself
so I could remember it. But I did that for about 6 months or 8 months, and then Dave left. Dave stopped teaching at the school. But by that time, I think I'd acquired a banjo, and from Johnny Long, who was a blues singer, and he had this old 1890s Washburn banjo that didn't have a head on it. It didn't have brackets, you know. He sold it to me for maybe $125, And I took it to John Calhoun, and he set it, fixed it up, got a head put on it, you know, tuned it all up, matched a piece of wood coloring with a yellow magic marker. I don't know how you do crazy stuff. And put this thing back together. It was beautiful. And I went and took lessons, banjo lessons with Fleming Brown.
Yeah.
And that's how
that was I think Fleming and I can't remember the name of the woman. Emmy? Do you remember Emmy?
I remember a woman, Emmy. I think she ran the Folklore Center.
She did run the Folklore store, Center, yeah. But she taught me, and there was another woman that taught me my beginning banjo when I was 10 years old. But that's why I like talking to people like you who were there in 1973, just before the school started kind of breaking up, you know. There's just that whole crew of people that were around since 1957.
Yeah.
We're starting to just move on, you know. And so this is a very nice, Emmy, I think, was her name.
Yeah. Yeah. And I taught, I took lessons there on banjo and fiddle, and for, it was probably about a year, year and a half, and I started bugging Ray Tate for a guitar teaching job, because I've been teaching guitar to my friends in my parents' basement, you know, that kind of thing. And he said, well, you know what, why don't you do some student teaching? You sit in with Dodie Kallick's kids' classes on Saturday morning. And Dodie was a woman who played the dulcimer and guitar and sang and performed around town. I'd see her at the No Exit.
Sure.
She lived up in Evanston. And so I did this quote-unquote student teaching bit with her for a session or two. And but no job had arisen. But in the late winter of maybe February or January of 74, I got a call from Bob Gans, and who was a teacher at the school. And Bob said, I'm going to be heading up the Old Town School of Folk Music North in Skokie. And would you like to come and teach private lessons there? Because I know you can teach guitar and fiddle and banjo. And I had just turned 17. And was still a junior in high school. And I still remember holding the phone. I mean, that was the most amazing. You could have told me I'd just been awarded the Nobel Prize, you know. I'm like, I'm going to teach at the Old Town School of Folk Music. Oh, my God. And so
I know the feeling. I
went
feeling.
Out there, yeah. And it was at 4101 West Main. And Main Music was a music store there. And Main Music kept the store, but they had Old Town take over the teaching.
Right.
And it was two sides of this building, and on one side they had one large room in the lobby, which they taught group classes, and then they had about five or six private lesson rooms. Mm-hmm. And Jethro Burns, the mandolin player from Homer and Jethro, taught there one day a week. And
now Homer and Jethro, you have to have for
Homer and Jethro were a country music comedy duo.
Comedy duo,
yeah.
They were very popular.
Very popular, yeah.
They had radio and television.
Yeah, yeah, they were great. And and Jethro lived. Homer had passed, but Jethro lived in Skokie, I think, or in Evanston. And he came out to teach one day a week, and coincidentally, it was a day that I was at the school, so I got to hang with him and get to know him. And Jim Hirsch, who was a wonderful finger-picking guitar player, was teaching there. And a number of nice people, great people. But after about 15 months, let's see, that was summer of 75, I graduated high school, and I took off. I went off to San Francisco, Colorado. I went to Mexico for about 5 months.
You're supposed to.
Had my guitar and my fiddle with me.
That's what you're supposed to do.
I bussed with the fiddle in San Francisco at Fisherman's Wharf, and that was the best 50. This guy Jerry had sold me this fiddle for $50. I don't know if he ever told his grandfather. It was his grandfather's fiddle, but it was the best $50 I ever spent. Right. And I come back in the winter of 75, and now Old Town North has moved to Evanston to the Noise Cultural Center.
Right.
And Jim Hirsch is running it.
He's running the show. Right.
And there was no room at the inn. They didn't have any openings for teaching. So I just started teaching in the neighborhood at local music stores, Flats and Sharp.
Flats and Sharp.
And up on Sheridan. And
Was Hawkeye open yet?
I don't think so. I don't remember. I don't know when Jim opened Hogeye up in Evanston, but
was his name Jan Berta? Was his name?
I don't remember. Yeah, I don't know Jan. What I did, come back. I moved to Europe for a few years and came back in 81 and hit 82 and hit Ray up for a job, and I taught fiddle on Armitage for a few years, and that was just after you had come back.
That's right, and I came back and as time went on, 1977, I'm looking for a job. And my dad, I said earlier, was a Chicago police officer. He says, hey, listen, you know, why don't you just take the police exams and see what comes up? Hey, and that's a natural progression, folk singer to a policeman, isn't it?
Sure.
I mean, doesn't everybody do that? I thought about it, and coming from a police family, I thought, well, and I love the cops. To this day, I'm just, I'm always amazed that people can go out there and, put themselves in a situation like they always have, especially at the times that I witnessed during those times. Wasn't always agreeing with it, but still, I knew what my father was like, and he was a good man. So I wanted to follow in his footsteps, and so I took the exams. Wound up going with the Cook County Sheriff's Police in 1977, and one of my first assignments in 1978 was the serial killer John Wayne Gacy. And because I'm a rookie, I was assigned the midnight shift to this happened around Christmas when he was discovered. 26 people buried underneath his house, that he had killed and buried underneath his house. Because of the time of year, Christmas, they postponed the excavation, but they needed policemen to stay inside the house 24/7, obviously, crime scene. And I was one of the police officers assigned on the midnight shift. Oh, goodness, 23, 24-year-old boy, young man who's never really experienced any kind of violence like this before. I said, oh, my goodness. But got through it, and that's all done. But I'm a little freaked out, right? I don't know if I want to do this job the rest of my life. Go home, and I tell my father, I said, oh, man. I got to start thinking about something else. And he suggested to me, he says, you remember that place that you went and learned how to play that banjo? I said, yeah, the Old Town School of Folk Music? Yeah. He says, these flyers still keep coming to the house here. Why don't you go back and get involved in that again? You like music. You're good at it. And I said, thought about it. And I went to the Armitage location. At the time, they had moved from North and Larrabee. Just very quietly signed up for classes. It was a very small venue at the time, although it was the popularity had diminished a bit, but at the same time, it was still a great place. Ray Tate was the director of the school at the time. And I got next to him. I was an advanced guitar player, so I took some advanced classes. And he took notice. After a while, probably about a year, he saw that I was there a lot. And he says, got to know me. He says, tell me about yourself. What do you do? And I told him this was in 1979. I said, I'm a police officer, blah, blah, blah. Oh, and he loved cops. He was just one of those guys, very accepting of everybody, and I was a little surprised, quite frankly. And he would invite me up on stage to play some songs, and which was, again, you talk about being intimidated, right? You're with Ray Tate and Bill Hanson and all of the great guys.
Dunbar.
Dunbar was there. Oh, my goodness.
Mike Dunbar.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of sitting off to the side, and people are giving you a high five, saying, hey, cool, cool. Once again, I felt like I was back in grade school, with my at the church. I said, wow, maybe I should do more of this. Anyway, Ray asked me to be a teacher there. He says, hey, would you mind teaching some of our beginning classes, probably like you on Saturdays? And the rest is history. I just hung around, and then it went through some real hard times. And you and I can take us through that, you know. When they were starting to transition, there was a time in between 1979 and 1982 that they were getting
going through some tough times.
They were getting ready to close. And that's where I think they were going to have a change in management. And that's when
Jim took over from Ray. Well, we came in for a meeting. We found out there was a board of directors.
Yeah.
No, I thought Ray ran it out of his wallet.
Who knew?
And they said, Ray's out, Jim's in. And we nodded our heads. But there were probably only about 15 or 20 of us teaching there.
Easily,
those days. And that was fun. But, you know, I think for me, though, it's, you know, and being back there now 11 years, because I didn't teach there for most of the 80s, 90s, and 2000s.
Right.
I came back in 2006.
Yeah.
And it's just all the friends, the community that I get to be teaching in a room where I first learned the fiddle 45, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, that's the wonderful thing. And, you know, we said we were going to talk about the all-night parties.
Oh.
Because in the 70s and the 80s, they used to have these all-night parties about 4 times a year.
Oh,
there was
easily.
Washington's birthday. There was the last blast before Christmas. There was maybe a 4th of July thing. And it was nonstop music, upstairs, downstairs.
Upstairs, downstairs. By that time, Michael Miles was involved, was the program director, I guess
maybe
he would have been.
Maybe by the 80s, yeah.
Yeah, Michael Miles was our go-to guy, released the boss. And then Jim Hirsch, of course, was the director. And, gosh, all the folks that were around.
I always take people up to room 7, and I say, this was the pot room
during the all-night
parties
the infamous
way back
pot
in the 70s.
Room.
Can you feel the vibe?
Yeah.
Because it was the one room looked out over the gangway, you know, and you couldn't see anything, right? You could open the window.
Yeah,
but,
and then,
but
you, then we had our folk policeman standing there. You know, wouldn't let you in unless you were cool.
We did. We had a.
Yeah, what was his name?
Patrick.
Patrick.
Oh, he was the bouncer from Earl
That's what
of
I mean.
Old Town. He was about 6'7". He used to stand on the landing
right.
of the staircase and only let 2 people go up if 2 people came down because we were worried about the floor
caving
important. In.
That
yeah.
was important. Because structurally,
that building.
That building. No.
And then they did close. Well, it was after that, after I left. In maybe, so I left in about 84 to focus on my
bartending
career.
There was
career.
A big fundraiser, 86 or 88, to renovate that
renovate
building.
Building.
It had to be.
Yeah.
And it was one of the biggest and most successful fundraisers, credit to, I'm sure, the board, but certainly Jim Hirsch, who organized this fantastic guy, brought outside people in, fundraising.
Jim
fundraising people.
The school. I think I think Jim really saved the school.
He saved
the
school,
80s.
And it was great. And we just had a good crew of people.
Learned how to raise money.
Learned how to raise money, yeah. And, man, did we made a lot of money.
Yeah. And the school's going to be 60 this year.
Yeah, 60 years old. And
just
now
like
it's,
me.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
And maybe it'll go on another
Hopefully it
60,
does.
Yeah.
Who's ever listening to this? If you're not at all familiar with the Old Town School of Folk
you're listening
music.
To this in the year 2070.
Yeah, please go take lessons
Check
at
the
Old
go
Town
see
School.
The Old Town School,
the Old Town School will be there in 2070. Yes. There's no doubt in my mind, in one way, shape, form, or another. And it's all about Americana music. That's mm-hmm. what it all started from. If you ever saw an old an old Western. And people were playing the fiddle, and it was all acoustic type of style music. That's how people entertained themselves forever in this country. That's how the Old Town School got started with Win Strachey and Don Greening.
And we may have
Fred,
a Beatles ensemble
Fred,
now and a Rolling
Frank
Stones
Hamilton.
Ensemble, but we still do it the same old folk music way.
Yeah, Woody Guthrie Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, those guys, those
Pete
folks.
Was a good friend of the school.
Great, yeah, he sure was, and that's what kind of influenced us as humans.
The people, I think, the people and the friendships in the community are
yeah.
really what's
it really was.
What's
it really
mattered.
Was.
And can I ask Michael, why did you decide to come back? Could you tell us a little bit about...
Why did I come back to teach in 2006? I had been I'd been teaching up at Flats and Sharp, and I had been traveling a lot. I was trying to emigrate to France again between 98 and 2005.
You had a pretty good gig going there for a while.
Yeah, and I was doing the kids show at Lincoln Park Zoo, and I was teaching. I was doing good, and but I'd got back to Chicago, and I needed some more work, and I went. I went and did a workshop or two at the school, and I got talking to Jimmy Tomasello, because this guy in France, this guitar teacher in France, and I
put a trip together. Jimmy's affiliation with the school at the time.
Then he was guitar program director.
He was the guitar program director,
in
correct,
2006, and still is.
Right.
And we, I had some project. I was trying to get guitar, see if I could take some guitar players over to France for a workshop, and this whole thing never worked out.
Right.
But Jimmy and I got back in touch, and he said, hey, you should be teaching here. I said,
he knew you from, the old days?
Yeah, we know each other from like early 80s. Yeah.
Oh, okay. There
and
you
I
go.
Said, yeah, you're right. I should be teaching here. And little by little, I built up a lot of classes, private students. And now I'm on Frank's faculty.
Look at
which
that.
Is a full time.
That's right.
It's just the first
That's
real
how much
job
would...
I've ever had.
Yeah.
It's been 11, almost 12 years I've been back there now.
Yeah, the Old Town School was just, we just made this humongous comeback. The place I'm saying 1998 was the next change we had, where we bought, or the city sold us, the Hill Library.
For a dollar.
For a dollar.
We put a few million into it.
We sure did. But we had the money for it,
yeah.
Plus another fundraiser. We knew how to do it then, and people were into it. Chicagoans, we put the Old Town School of Folk Music on the map.
Yeah.
Joni Mitchell even came and did a, how much was that ticket to get into that if you wanted
to? I don't know.
It was ridiculous. It was like $1,000, I think, for you to get a ticket to go to the Joni Mitchell fundraiser concert. It was fantastic, but there were protesters outside. The Old Town School, they sold out, or Joni sold out. I don't know. It was something. They paid her $1 million, didn't they?
I don't know.
They paid her a lot of money. Incredible. Or $100,000, maybe. I'm thinking $1 million, that's a little bit too much. But I think $100,000 for her to do that gig. You don't remember that.
Good times.
But the Old Town School of Folk Music saved my life. And I'm glad that I was a part of it. Certainly, I'm sure.
It's done a lot for me. I met my wife there.
There you go. Look at that.
Yeah, in 2007. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Good joint.
Yes, sir.
Any last words? Or you feel pretty good?
Well, any last words? Let me think in conclusion. All I can say is that the Old Town School, because of that influence of my music ever since 1963 for me, I'm so happy that this place was in my life and able to keep me focused.
Yeah, I agree. It's been a big, ever since I was 15, it's been a big influence, even when I wasn't there.
Right,
What a great joint.
It really is.
Glad for the people, glad for the times.
And go. Anybody in the future, hey, please, enjoy it. Get off of YouTube. And go there and take some guitar lessons, please, because it's like anything else.
It'll nourish your soul and change your life.
There you go.